Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Monday, October 13th. Happy Indigenous Peoples Day. I'm Gabriel Zucker, reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, fatal vehicle-pedestrian collision in Garberville leaves one dead. Humboldt Soups debate offshore oil drilling opposition. Burn permit suspensions lifted by CAL FIRE Humboldt Del Norte and CAL FIRE Mendocino. And power outage in Arcata leaves 109 without power. Stay tuned. These stories and more coming up.
Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located on the unceded territory of the Tsingkiyon, Wailaki, Wiyot, Wilcut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection these tribes have to this region.
Yesterday, a vehicle versus pedestrian collision on State Route 162 left one dead in Garberville. Nat Cardos reports.
Yesterday, October 12th, at approximately 7:59 p.m., California Highway Patrol Garberville area units were dispatched to State Route 162, north of Poonkinney Road, for a vehicle versus pedestrian crash. The Humboldt Communications Center, HCC, was notified that the vehicle then fled the scene. Prior to CHP arrival, medical personnel provided life-saving measures, but ultimately the victim was pronounced dead on the scene. State Route 162 was shut down for about 4.5 hours during the investigation. KMUD News spoke with Christian Zepeda, California Highway Patrol Public Information Officer, for more information on the incident.
So on October 12th at around 19:59 hours, CHP responded to a vehicle collision versus a pedestrian on SR-162 just north of Poonkinney Road. Prior to CHP arrival, medical personnel was already on scene and was providing life-saving measures, but ultimately pronounced the pedestrian deceased. Witness accounts placed the pedestrian within the lanes of travel of SR-162 when a Toyota 4Runner driven by Sandra Acosta de Loera struck the pedestrian and, for reasons unknown, she fled the scene. Later on, she contacted dispatch, which officers responded to the address of the driver, conducted an investigation, and thus concluding that part of the investigation for that night.
The identity of the victim is being withheld pending notification of next of kin. The crash is still under active investigation by CHP Garberville area, and if anyone has pertinent information regarding the crash, they are encouraged to call the CHP Garberville office at 707-932-6100. This is Nat Cardos reporting for KMUD News.
Though not unanimous, the Humboldt County Board of Supervisors wants the county to be ready to oppose offshore oil drilling. Daniel Mintz reports.
A majority of Humboldt County supervisors have reiterated the county's longstanding opposition to offshore oil and gas drilling and deep-sea mining. Discussed and approved at the October 7th Board of Supervisors meeting, a resolution opposing offshore oil drilling comes in response to reports that the federal administration plans to announce new offshore oil leases as early as this month. Supervisor Mike Wilson brought the resolution forward and said its urgency is due to the changing federal landscape, including the judicial overturning of a prior executive order banning new offshore oil exploration on the West Coast and some areas of the East Coast. The resolution calls for establishing Humboldt County as an active participant in a coastwide opposition effort and appointing a representative to it. The effort got support during a public comment period, including from a speaker highlighting potential fisheries impacts.
Humboldt County is a commercial fishing community, and because of the potential harm offshore drilling and mining poses to our fishing community, including catastrophic oil spills, routine toxic pollution, and disruption of marine ecosystems, support for this resolution, to me, is the only rational and logical decision to make.
Another speaker warned that deep-sea mining devastates the groundfish industry. But Supervisor Rex Bone questioned whether offshore oil and mining should be opposed.
The basis I can see, but I just don't know if the threat's there to be doing this. I mean, I see the same thing of what you're trying to do, and then I see with all the work that is still going to take place, or we're pushing to take place out in the ocean, that could cause, you know, comparable damage, not as much, mind you. And I read once somewhere that more oil comes up through cracks in the bottom of the ocean floor than the Valdez spilled. So that's always an amazing, if I don't know fact true, but it is, it's on the internet, so it must be true. I just think we're pushing it a little too far, and I don't know if the advocacy is always going to be probably what everybody in Humboldt County would want. So I'm not sure where I'll go on this.
Wilson said there's federal movement towards setting up offshore drilling leases, and quick responses from local governments will likely be needed. The springboard for doing that is the newly forming statewide local government coalition that Wilson said will strategize unified opposition and provide information to the governor's office. He said it's important for Humboldt County to be part of it.
It's coming. For one, the call is going to be made likely in the next few months from the federal government for leasing and potentially for mining as well. There's been executive orders already from the Trump administration in support of that. And so the agencies, I guess you say, word on the street is the agencies have been working diligently to get those offerings up as soon as possible. It could be, like I said, in the next few weeks. And so by approving this position, we basically can authorize staff to just move forward with taking a position when those come up.
Board Chair Michelle Bushnell signaled intent to abstain from voting, citing a lack of information and discomfort with appointing a representative to a coalition that is not yet formed. A motion to approve the resolution and appoint Wilson to the formative coalition was approved, with Wilson, Supervisor Natalie Arroyo, and Supervisor Steve Madrone voting for it. Bone voted against it, and Bushnell abstained. The motion directs the county administrative officer to engage in advocacy reflecting the county's opposition. That will include adding opposition to offshore oil to the county's legislative lobbying platform. In Eureka for KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
CAL FIRE Humboldt Del Norte Unit and CAL FIRE Mendocino Unit announced today that the burn permit suspensions that were set in place earlier this year in June have been lifted due to increased rain and overall weather. Nat Cardos reports.
CAL FIRE Humboldt Del Norte Unit and CAL FIRE Mendocino Unit announced that the burn permit suspensions that were set in place back in June have been lifted. A burn permit is a document that gives the holder permission to have an open fire for purposes such as clearing debris and hazard reduction burning. The suspension was put in place due to fire season, but with increased rain and overall current weather conditions, the suspension has been lifted. KMUD News spoke to Jeremy Ward, Battalion Chief with the CAL FIRE Humboldt Del Norte Unit, for more information about the burn permit suspension being lifted.
Based on the current weather conditions here locally, as well as in the region, along with fire activity, has allowed us to get to a point where we can lift that burn suspension and allow people to start burning their piles. We do require that folks follow all those permit terms so that they are being able to burn safely and not threaten the escape of fire or, you know, potentially causing damage to neighboring properties, because sometimes that does happen when folks don't burn as they're supposed to.
Burn permits outline the rules and regulations people must follow when conducting burns. Some of these rules include conducting burns in a manner that would prevent smoke from creating a smoke nuisance, maximum pile size being only 4 feet in diameter, keeping water supply close to the burn site, adult attendance of the fire, including more. It also advises when and where these can be conducted. Ward elaborates more on the standards for burn permits.
So the burn permits are for a few reasons. First, air quality requires a permit all times of the year when folks are burning. That is more geared towards their concerns are, you know, air quality. But CAL FIRE, we require a burn permit each year in this unit beginning May 1st. That requirement will continue until sometime early summer when we have to suspend burning due to the fire danger. And then later in the year, like today, once we've got some sufficient weather and a decrease in fire activity, then we can allow that burning to happen again. but we're still going to require a burn permit. And the reason for that burn permit is for a couple of things. One, it lets us know where the folks are trying to burn, and if necessary, it helps us provide some additional direction on what needs to be done so that the public can burn safely. And two, there's a set of standards that's in that burn permit that gives people the guidance as far as what actions they need to do so that they're making sure that their fires stay within control. And I can tell you from my experience, working in fire prevention for about 10 years now, is that escape debris fires are preventable, and they are almost always a result of one of several factors. And that is people are not staying in attendance to their burn, people who do not have clearance around their burn, or folks who burn when it's windy or when the wind picks up later on after they started burning. So those are the fires that we see escape. And sometimes people, you know, they do not follow those permits, and there's times where they're able to get away with it and don't have an escape. But it's only a matter of time until the conditions are just right so that it's not favorable, and that's how fires get away.
There are multiple different types of burn permits available: residential, general and broadcast, and campfire permits. Steps that burn permit holders must follow include calling CAL FIRE and making the required notifications as set by their permit. This informs CAL FIRE that the fire is not unwanted so that they don't have to send unneeded resources to the scene. Second, permit havers must verify that they are within a state responsibility area, as CAL FIRE permits are only valid for SRA residents or where CAL FIRE has jurisdiction. Lastly, double-check if the permit is usable or needs to be renewed. Ward explains more of the requirements as well as tips for conducting a burn.
First, make sure that they're calling to make sure it is a permissive burn day. The next step would be to make sure that they call and make the required notifications that are on their permit. That prevents us from having to send resources out unnecessarily when we know that there's a burn pile that's supposed to be occurring somewhere. Because otherwise, if we don't know that, you know, we suspect it's some sort of unwanted fire and we have to send a full resource response, which requires a lot of equipment depending on the time of day and the location and the weather. And we want to try and eliminate that. So that is a requirement of the permit, is to make those proper notifications. And then again, like I said, make sure that folks are following all those terms of their permit. Make sure they're staying in attendance. Don't burn when it's windy. And have some clearance around your pile. And if folks would do that, then we'd have a lot less escape debris burns.
To apply for a burn permit and to learn more, the website is burnpermit.fire.ca.gov. This is Nat Cardos reporting for KMUN News.
An unplanned PGE outage that occurred in Arcata at approximately 1:30 p.m. today left 109 customers without power, Nat Cardos reports.
At approximately 1:29 p.m. today, a PG&E power outage was reported in the Arcata area. The outage affected 109 customers, and initial reports from PG&E stated that power would be back by approximately 9:15 p.m. As of writing, power has been restored to all but two residences. KMUN News spoke with Megan McFarland, spokesperson for PG&E, for more information on the outage.
So this afternoon, in the Arcata area, we had a power outage impacting about 109 customers. Started at 1:30 in the afternoon, and our crews immediately reported to the scene. And what was happening is we had a pole that needed pretty much immediate replacement. We had done an assessment, and the pole just needed to come out and be replaced. So we got our crews out there, did that right away. Originally, the estimated time of restoration was later this evening, I think around 9:15 p.m., and that's kind of auto-generated in our system so we can give customers an idea of when the power might go back on. And it's based on sort of historical outages and what that kind of pole replacement, the length of time it typically takes. But fortunately, the crews were able to work safely and efficiently, and it looks like all customers have been restored except two.
To report outages, the website is pgealerts.alerts.pge.com. KMUN News will continue to provide future outage updates to listeners affected in our broadcast area. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Nat Cardos.
Turning to Mendocino, DEA recall efforts rejected and water rates triple in Hopland. Mendo Local News' Elise Cox reports.
In Mendocino County, a citizen-led effort to recall District Attorney David Eister has hit a snag. Last week, the county registrar of voters said she has rejected the recall group's paperwork. Katrina Bartlame, the county registrar, assessor, and clerk, told us, quote, "The published notice of intent to recall has several errors and did not match what was served Mr. Eister." If the recall group resubmits corrected documents, they'll have 160 days to collect 8,200 valid signatures. But there are financial considerations. Bartlemy estimates a countywide recall election could cost between $300,000 and $350,000. Meanwhile, Mendocino County Chief Executive Officer Darcy Antle has told the Board of Supervisors that the county is on track to run a $3 million deficit. In other news, the Hopland Public Utilities District voted Thursday to impose a steep rate increase for water and sewer services provided by the Ukiah Valley Water Authority to the district. The board's decision will triple water costs for 330-plus customers over the next decade, with the first round of increases taking effect on November 1st. At a packed hearing on Thursday at Britico Sellers, residents expressed frustration with the proposed rates. They asked for more information about a claim that the hike was necessary to pay for a state mandate to move water and sewer lines to accommodate a Caltrans ADA project. Here's resident Vernon Buttinger.
Now, I don't know what kind of construction index you're working on, but there is no construction index right now that's forecasting that construction costs are going to go from $2 million to $4 million or $5 million, or from $3 million to even $4 million.
Buttinger questioned the lack of standard cost estimates, as well as the inflated inflation predictions for services provided by the Ukiah Valley Water Authority.
This whole thing is like a smokescreen for them to raise their costs and their administration to the city of Ukiah. I mean, I'm sorry, but together with the water and the sewer, the repair and rehabilitation is going to be $200,000 a year. And I checked that against all the other local utilities all up and down the North Bay, and that is probably about twice as much as the rest of them.
Another resident, Tina Moody, was equally critical.
Well, look around. We're not Sebastopol. We're not Healdsburg. That income isn't here. The employers aren't here. The money's not here. So are you just willing to put everybody in the red? Are you just willing to have everybody's accounts go delinquent?
Financial consultant Mark Hildebrand said the increases were necessary regardless of whether Caltrans proceeded with the ADA project.
There's still a lot of correcting to do to get to the point where you can sustain the $100,000 a year of capital spending that needs to happen year in, year out. Because ultimately, you know, when we look back, the Caltrans project will eventually be a one-time expense that hurt for a second and or hurt for a number of years, but will eventually become part of the past. But going forward, you have to establish a revenue base that can support the utility into the future. And so that's what you would need to have these rate increases either way, with or without Caltrans.
Jared Walker from the Ukiah Valley Water Authority warned of potential state intervention if the district doesn't maintain its system.
There's Senate Bill 88, which is 1B, or refer to it as SB 88. But what it really is a system. Municipality is defunct, right? We've got bad water quality. We're constantly in violation with the state. We have no money.
Okay.
The state can come in under SB 88 and take over your agency or force you to consolidate with someone else.
Okay. Then we have no control.
I don't think the community of Hopland wants to be governed by the state.
The board approved the rate increases despite the fact that nearly 36% of ratepayers submitted protest letters. Some were sure the number of ratepayers opposed was even higher. You can read more on mendolocal.news. Reporting for KMUD News, I'm Elise Cox from Mendo Local Public Media.
In state news, All In for Safe Schools addresses immigration, LGBTQ policy. Public News Service's Suzanne Potter reports.
This month, the All In for Safe Schools Coalition is releasing resources for early childhood educators, including preschools and daycare centers, on how to follow the law and create safe spaces for families during this time of increased immigration enforcement. The one-pager advises providers to update their emergency contacts so the children don't end up with Child Protective Services. Lisa Davis with the Children's Partnership says it's also a good idea to update security and privacy protocols.
things like which staff member is authorized to speak with an immigration agent should they show up at their center, how they're storing and releasing private information about parents, children, and staff.
The coalition also advises providers to create a plan for communicating urgent information to staff and parents when an ICE action takes place. Facilities can also establish private spaces within the building that are not open to the public, triggering Fourth Amendment protections, which require a judicial warrant for law enforcement to enter. Davis says the coalition is working on a second set of guidelines for K-12 schools on how to create a welcoming atmosphere for LGBTQ+ and immigrant students.
Some of it is gender-affirming, like using pronouns and bathrooms, but then special accommodations, data privacy, so that they're not outed to family members and or other support people without their consent.
Providers can get more information at allinforsafeschools.org. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
In national news, mass firings begin on day 10 of government shutdown. Trump says firing will be Democrat-oriented, KPFA's Christopher Martinez reports.
The federal government shutdown entered day 10 Friday, and the firings have begun. Office of Management and Budget Director Russell Vogt posted a social media message reading, "The RIFs have begun," referring to reduction in force firing notices. President Donald Trump explained the guiding principle as he spoke to reporters in the White House.
And it will be Democrat-oriented because we figure, you know, they started this thing, so they should be Democrat-oriented. It'll be a lot, and we'll announce the numbers over the next couple of days, but it'll be a lot of people.
The administration has not given details of the firings, but according to a new court filing, the administration laid off more than 4,100 workers Friday. That filing comes from a lawsuit filed by federal workers just before the shutdown began. The numbers include workers at the Departments of Education, Commerce and Energy, and Housing and Urban Development, but they do not include firings at, for example, the Environmental Protection Agency. The firings are intended to ramp up pressure on Democrats to agree to the Republican spending plan. Democratic Congressmember Rosa DeLauro of Connecticut told reporters, "It's just the proverbial pig in the you-know-what. He loves it because he's just accumulating power because the president does not know anything about budgets or about appropriations." Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson says Republicans are trying to get back to sound fiscal responsibility, and that means cutting spending.
Government spends too much. It's too large. It does too many things. It does almost nothing well. As Reagan used to remind us, government is not the solution to the problem. Government is the problem. And so are we in favor of reducing spending? Yes, that we're trying to do that in a responsible manner.
He also said Democrats are, in his words, pandering to their far-left activist base. Johnson was speaking at a news conference on the shutdown, where he also took the opportunity to blast an upcoming rally against the Trump administration.
We've heard, and many of you have reported already, this Hate America rally that they have coming up for October 18th. The Antifa crowd and the pro-Hamas crowd and the Marxists, they're all going to gather on the Mall. We got some House Democrats selling T-shirts for this event. It is an outrageous gathering for outrageous purposes, but the Democrats in the Senate have shown that they're afraid of that crowd, that they don't want to bow, that they want to bow to them, bow the knee to them, and they don't want to take incoming from them. And so they're willing to hold the American people hostage so that they don't have to face an angry mob of that's a big chunk of their base.
Speaker Johnson says he'll keep the House out of session until Democrats vote to reopen government. House Democratic leader Hakeem Jeffries, on the other hand, takes his aim at President Trump and Republican lawmakers.
Donald Trump's strategy during this government shutdown that he has created has been to play golf and issue deepfake videos. Mike Johnson's strategy is to keep House Republicans on vacation. John Thune's strategy is to continue to do the same partisan thing over and over and over again and expect different results. That's legislative insanity. Our plea to our Republican colleagues is get serious about reopening the government.
Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
In national native news, Antonia Gonzalez reads today's headlines.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Indigenous health workers are stepping up their battle against opioid addictions. As the Mountain West News Bureau's Jenny Kenzie reports, tribal communities are looking for solutions to the ongoing crisis.
Indigenous people have been especially hard hit by the national opioid epidemic. Their use is highest among all U.S. populations, and use has been increasing dramatically in recent years. Chris Lovato is a community health representative on the Santo Domingo Pueblo in New Mexico. Lovato says the problem is widespread and has even tracked opioid addictions in children as young as 9 and 13.
We did experience the 13-year-old hallucinating, just kind of not coherent. And, you know, of course, 911 was called. And after a couple of days, we got the, you know, information that he was high on meth.
Funds to fight the crisis come from the federal government's Tribal Opioid Response Program and settlements from lawsuits against opioid manufacturers and distributors. 5 tribal nations in New Mexico and more from out of state are expected to attend a summit on the Santa Ana Pueblo to look for solutions in November. I'm Jenny Kinsey.
The Phoenix, Arizona area is increasingly becoming a hub for data centers powering artificial intelligence. And as KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports, even tribes are beginning to tackle the trade-offs.
From language and culture to tribal courts and health, the applications are seemingly endless.
There's not been a conference on AI in Indian country at all, to my knowledge. And so this is really the first time bringing people together.
Tracy Morris, who is Chickasaw and executive director of ASU's American Indian Policy Institute, says she and her team will draft a white paper on takeaways from the day-long Wiring the Res gathering in downtown Phoenix. Among them was critical dialogue about natural resources, a topic initially missing from the agenda, but later added.
After we saw stuff on our social media saying, well, what about what it's doing to the environment? I'm like, okay, let's add a panel. We got space.
Chris Deschaney, who is Navajo and executive director of the National Intertribal Energy Council, says few tribes are in the position to consider building data centers on their lands.
Most of Indian country is not impacted by this, but it does impact, for example, if you have utility rates.
Arizona Utilities, APS, and Tucson Electric Power are now proposing a 14% hike for ratepayers, largely driven by rising energy demands from data centers. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
Events were held over the weekend and continue through Monday across the country to celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day. In Berkeley, California, Saturday, the annual Indigenous Peoples Day powwow and Indian market was held. It included intertribal dancing, contest dancing, native foods, arts, and crafts. Organizers say this year's powwow marks 33 years of the holiday, honoring ancestors, people of today, and future generations. In Nevada earlier this year, state lawmakers passed a bill to officially recognize Indigenous Peoples Day as the second Monday in October, but the governor vetoed the measure. According to Native Voters Alliance Nevada, the Native community is still celebrating and invited elected officials, allies, and the greater Las Vegas community to kick off Indigenous Peoples Day at the Welcome to Fabulous Las Vegas sign to honor the holiday. The event includes a ceremonial lighting, speakers, and a preview of future legislative plans. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Javier Rodriguez, and thanks to our reporters, Nat Cardos, Daniel Mintz, Elise Cox, Suzanne Potter, Christopher Martinez, and Antonio Gonzalez. KMUD News is online. You can find us on kmud.org, now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. You can also follow us on social media. If you have any questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org. Are you passionate about your community? Looking to report what's happening around Mendocino? KMUD News is looking for string of reporters from the Mendocino area to cover local Mendocino stories that matter. Whether you're a seasoned journalist or just eager to learn, we'll help you get started. You'll get training, support, and a chance to amplify real voices from your community. If you're interested, email news@kmud.org for more information. Redwood Community Radio, Inc. is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Gabriel Zucker.